UCR podcast.
I am here to tell you that Henry Rollins is one of us. While you might know him as the former frontman of bands like Black Flag and his own Rollins Band, a common thread that has followed him throughout his career is that he is, in fact, a major music nerd with an insatiable appetite for acquiring albums and musical ephemera. And I didn't know any of this at the beginning of the 90s when I first started listening to Rollins Band, and specifically the End of Silence album. But as I started to get into his spoken word, I hear him telling stories about Ronnie James Dio and Black Sabbath, and there's the moment where you realize, okay, this guy makes music, but he is also a big music fan. And of course, we've gotten to see that in a lot of different ways over the years, including the time period where he was hosting the very underrated Henry Rollins Show on IFC, and also his radio show, which continues to this day on KCRW. And 20 years ago, Henry started putting out a series of books called Fanatic, featuring the notes and annotations that he made about the songs he was playing on his radio show. He put out three volumes of those books between 2004 and 2007. In 2019, he started a new series of books, beginning with Stay Fanatic Volume 1, Hectic Expectorations for the Music Obsessive. Rollins has now put out a total of four books under the Stay Fanatic banner, including his latest one, Stay Fanatic Volume 4, Lessons in Possession and Confessions of Obsession. And as he told me, these books are his version of a fanzine, a love letter to music, and a chance for him to document the musical experiences that he's having, the things that he's listening to, from Wire and the Buzzcocks to Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, so many other things. Henry's got multiple pressings of many of his favorite records, and if you talk to him, he can tell you why, but he's also got favorite albums that he only listens to at certain times of the year. I could go on, but in short, he's a big music fan, as I said, like us, and also someone who is working to preserve the history of the music that we all love. And there was a lot to get into with Henry, so we will break this discussion into two parts. For those of you that have heard a lot of interviews with Henry, I took that into consideration as well and had a goal to hit some different topics. Now, you can find the latest Stay Fanatic book at henryrollins.com, where you will also find information on everything else he has going on, including any upcoming shows as they're announced. An additional note, some of the older volumes of Stay Fanatic are also available on ebook wherever you get your books. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, please follow so that you'll get future episodes delivered as they're released. And if you enjoy what you're hearing, do us a favor and rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy it. Here's the first part of our conversation with Henry Rollins.
Is that you, Matt?
That is me. How are you, man?
Oh, I'm good. You got here early.
You'll appreciate this. I did an interview at one point. It was at one of the Ozfest festivals. I was there early for the interview, and the label guy just said, without prompt, he said, "You wait for Judas Priest. Judas Priest doesn't wait for you." He kind of barked that at me and then like stormed off. I was like, okay. So I always kind of keep that in mind. I've always been on time, but it's kind of one of those things that's like, yeah, that's a good point, you know?
But then you meet Rob Halford and he's like the coolest guy.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I met him, of all places, in Tokyo, 1994, I believe. He had that band Fight, and his solo band. And they were, him and his band were staying at the same hotel we were, at Roppongi, which is like the, you know, big tourist intersection, lots of shops and lights. And he was in the lobby doing some interview, and I walked by him and went, "Henry Rollins." I went, "Whoa, Judas Priest, man." And he like the coolest guy. And I've been pals with him ever since. Really cool.
That's fantastic. I made some notes because we have a lot of Fanatic topics to discuss.
And, okay.
Man, I'm just like thrilled that you continue to put these things out. And thank you for doing this. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Before we fully dig in, I wanted to ask, because we have a sister website dedicated to Prince called Ultimate Prince. I wondered, did you ever meet Prince? Do you have any Prince stories?
No, none. Only, let's see, a mini story. Ween, the great duo, the genius. Ween, I think, was doing a publishing deal with Warner Chappell at some point. This is like 128 years ago. And they're huge Prince fans, those two. And Prince was doing his publishing for, I don't know much about the guy, at least for a time, with Warner Chappell. And so a lot of times those people who write a bunch of songs, they have those reels where it's like a verse and a chorus and it fades so you can't steal it. But if Kris Kristofferson wants to put a vocal on that, they'll kindly take the publishing action. And so Prince, who writes like a 20 songs a day or something, he had these reels of him singing songs. And somehow they were, these demo reels were given to Ween. And I think it was Andrew, who was in the band I was in, he's a bass player, he got a copy. And so in our van, we're listening to like these like fragments of songs. And you're like, wait a minute, that's in a Chrysler ad. And wait a minute, that's like the guy was in the world you didn't even know when you were listening to Prince. And there's at least one or two of those, like, you got the right one, baby. Like, wait a minute, I've heard that before. Dude, that's you. And so Prince had this whole other life in you know, with his publishing, to where you never knew it was that guy. And so it was a bunch of Prince. I never got a copy of any of this. So it was a bunch of Prince music that, you know, normal folks never heard. But we just were, we lucked out because of the Ween hookup. And I never got close to meeting that guy. You know, I was just never in the same, just not in the same orbit. But my bandmates were huge Prince fans. And I just kind of knew him, you know, adjacently. I knew who he was in the world. But my bandmates were all over it. And because of them, it kind of seeped into me. And I ended up being a huge fan of the Love Sexy album and the Black album. Those were the two that really did it for me. And the Rain, the Graffiti Bridge soundtrack, which I just thought had that great, what was the time, had that band, had that song that I think Prince wrote for him called The Skillet. Oh, it's yeah. just a great, great music. And somewhere in the early 90s, that Black album came out. I got it first as a CD bootleg, and then I got the official CD. It kind of like slopped over the side for a minute, and I was in LA, and they were kind of everywhere for like a weekend. And I missed out on the vinyl. Like, there's like the real vinyl for a minute. There's a bootleg vinyl. I never caught up with that.
That's what I love about you is that, like, I mean, I grew up and almost immediately was like working in record stores and, you know, had way too much music before I even got into radio. I'd been to way too many concerts before I got into radio and all that. So it seems like just like by virtue of the things that you've done, musically, there's not really anything that has kind of escaped your radar, even if it's something like Prince or whatever it is. Like, I feel like there could be a Henry Rollins game based on all the things I've read you write about, where it's like you can throw any artist and band at you and you're going to have some sort of thought about it, just because I would guess, like, just being a music fanatic as you are and also somebody that has done music for your entire life, you're just exposed to so much.
And it's for also for trying, you know, willfully asking questions. Well, what are you into? Well, what does that do? Can I hear that? They're like, hey, there's a record store. Well, let's go. And so and just being around people, like, obviously, you know, some band called Sonic Youth and some guy named Thurston Moore. That guy has forgotten more about music than I will ever know. I mean, he's a very bright guy, but he's this walking encyclopedia of music knowledge. And like, you can throw kind of sort of anything out there. The more avant and obscure, the more he'll go, oh yeah, well, when I met him in 19, you're like, ah, I can't stand it. Like, and he's so A to Z. And he turned me on to a lot of jazz many years ago. He'd make me these jazz one, jazz two, these jazz cassettes, which I still have. And he turned me on to, like, you know, Eiler and like early Sun Ra stuff and Cecil Taylor and all this other stuff that I probably maybe would have connected with. So I just became aware of people like Byron Coley, a Thurston Moore alum, a great writer, a music know-a-lot. And I used to see Byron quite a bit at SST Records, where I lived and worked with Black Flag. He would come in and help us with our radio charts. He's another guy who's, you know, has forgotten more about music than I'll ever know. And people like that would see my enthusiasm. They go, well, like, you better check out these John Cale records. Well, okay.
Yeah.
And so one thing leads to another, and suddenly, you know, obviously you never have enough money for the records you want. But in my early 20s, I'm in Black Flag, which is a pretty scorched earth proposition. But I'm listening to like Diamant de Galas, Einstürzende Neubauten, mm-hmm. George Crumb, the avant pianist or composer, and listening to KCRW, the station that I work at now, which is like really eclectic. And it's all sounding interesting to me. And one of the main DJs there sadly passed away many years ago, Deirdre O'Donoghue. Like she was like friends with Laurie Anderson and friends with Eno and Fripp and all these people. And I'd go over to her apartment with blank cassettes. Everyone thought we were dating. We weren't. I would just crash on her couch between tours because she had food, coffee, and records. And she, you know, she fed me. And I would just make these tapes of like Harold Budd, you know, the great pianist, Eno and Fripp solo records, and all these records I can't afford. But Deirdre has them, you know, all the way up into her garage in the parking lot. She's stuffed with records. And I would just make these cassettes and go, take them out on tour, play them to death, come back and put new music on the cassettes from Deirdre and other people. And you just find people who are into a lot of music. And you ask, and, you know, when someone shows enthusiasm about music, you're happy to help them. Like, oh, dude, you need to, here, take these home, bring them back next year. You want to help them out because you dig the enthusiasm. And so I was around a lot of people who listened to a lot of music. And I just realized, especially growing up with my mom, who had like pitch perfect taste in music. Yeah, she played everything from Mary McCabe to Dylan and like Stravinsky, Bartok, Streisand, show tunes. Like we listened to everything, rarely watched TV, but the records were on like she was a DJ. And it just made me kind of music curious. And then in your 20s, you got all that energy, enthusiasm. I just realized, in my opinion, at least every genre has great records, insane stories, like musicians, they're all crazy. You know, as far as like all the drugs, and bedlam, country western, like they're the biggest psychos. And there's stories, there's great music, there's bad contracts, there's drama. It's like Shakespeare. You know, everyone, you know, has a bad divorce, and there's just so it's epic where you can just spend your life studying Johnny Cash. Like there's so much. And that's why I'll never say I know a lot about music. I'm just a fan because it's like a sea. And at best, you'll dip your cup in, and then you die. But you can have a really good time trying to know. And that's kind of my aptitude and attitude with music. I am here to receive it. And I'm 63 years old with a radio show where I'm trying to convince my listeners I'm not too old and in the way. So I'm listening to records made by, like, you know, obstreperous 22-year-olds, like, all the time. Because youth music still sounds good to me. I just, you know, I think independent music hasn't been better than it has been for like the last 10 years with a lot of people.
Yeah, agreed.
Like Ty Siegel, John Dwyer, the OCs, like they have, you know, they have the means. So instead of buying luxury cars, they buy their own studios. They're making their own records. So independent music is finally independent because they own the label. Like Discord. Like no one tells Ian MacKay what to put out. Like, but, you know, and he's kind of one of those guys who's old like me doing it. But there's a lot of your younger, newer, shinier folks who just quickly, like, ah, I got some money. Bam, I bought a microphone. I got a building. I got a drum set. I'm making records. Oh, I'll make a label. And the records are, without compromise, absolutely brilliant. And you can hear the real thing. Like humans, you know, your analog ear can hear the real thing. You can't fool a person, really. You know, if the band sucks, it doesn't last for long. And so when you hear this good music, you're like, man, when old people my age are like, oh, music's boring now. I'm like, wow, you're boring now. You just turned into your parents. I'm so sad. I'm so sad to be at your wake while you're still breathing.
That's what I appreciate. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, and that's what keeps me at my old age still enthusiastic about Record Store Day and eBay and Discogs and having a want list and, you know, hitting the record store before soundcheck, you know, in whatever country you're in, because you never know what's in there. And if I ever lose that enthusiasm, which thankfully gets worse and worse for me as I get older, I would hate that because it's like kind of that eternal happy place, which I've had since I started going to a record store with intensity, like at age 18. Like every weekend, I'm at that record store trying to find punk rock records.
Yeah, and you know, I appreciate, like, I know that you've kind of talked about the pros and cons of, I'll say the pros and cons of Discogs, but for example, my wife wrote a book about Duran Duran's Rio for the 33 and a third series. And
oh, wow.
So as she was in the midst of researching that, you know, writing it and then it being out and all that kind of stuff, she starts buying all these different pressings and variants of Rio. And there was one point that one of the particular pressings that was the rarest one, and I know you've run into this, she bought it, it showed up, it wasn't the right pressing. So
yep,
that's definitely one of the cons. I mean, you've spoken to that, but on the other side of things, don't you really appreciate having something like Discogs where, even unlike eBay, you know, a lot of times on Discogs, compared to eBay, where it might be you have to bid on it, all that kind of stuff, Discogs, you go, you buy it. Like, as music fans, as fanatics, as you would say, we've come so far from the days where it's like you went in the record store and it was there or it wasn't.
Yep. Well, as I always say, Discogs is a great service. I've been to the site easily 15 times today. And I just, you know, I have all on my laptop, I have all these little bookmarks. So I hit like this band on eBay. And I mean, I'm all over it. Omega auction sites. I'm looking all over, turning over every stone. And for me, the downside is you get that kind of amateur seller. And Discogs more than once has come to me like, hey, write a thing for Discogs. I'm like, you know what? You all need to vet your sellers more, because I'm now sending back a David Bowie 7-inch to a guy in Venezuela because I got it wrong and I'm eating the postage and I might not get the money. And like the guy, you know, we're all here for rock and roll. Like there's a truce. Like I'm not going to be, how can I be a jerk? I like Led Zeppelin. Like how can you get in a fight with a guy wearing a Damned t-shirt? There's an automatic, you see a guy in a Ramon shirt. He's kind of an ally. Like, and that's why I hate it when you see, you know, there's photos of people who get their flyers signed with the guy in the band and they take the photo and the guy signing the flyer is like, hey man, great. And then the guy puts it on eBay the next day and the photo was only done so the buyer can see the dude really did sign it. Like you're not a fan of that band. You just want money and you should have cut the guy in. And that to me is like, you broke the promise. Like that the guy signed that flyer for you because you said, oh, I'm a fan. And we all kind of meet at this place because we're just kooks who like music and we're all friendly because you don't bring your sword to this, but you brought the sword of capitalism. And if you can't be bothered to get the freaking pressing right, you know, on Discogs, and like, look how angry this is making. Like you waste time. And when, you know, and I've written these people, I meant like, this isn't the South African pressing of this Buzzcocks record. And they got right back, well, whatever, collector boy. Like, no, you need to be honest in your advertising. Like, don't sell me something else. If I did that to you and it was groceries and I sold you rotten, you know, whatever, I'd lose my job and there'd be a class action lawsuit. And like, it's you're safe from me in France, but man, if you live down the street from me, your property would be on fire. So, and it irks me. And I actually lost a 7-inch the other day because I wrote the guy, I go, is this really what it is? And someone snapped it up. So I'll never know if it was the real thing or not. I'm so mad about it. I'll never see another one again, I'm sure. But that's my only drawback with Discogs. Because I don't sell anything. I'm just a buyer. And if I was ever a seller on any of those sites, I'll go, this is exactly as it is listed. I'm that guy. I know you want to know this, you know, gentle buyer. And so that's like my only hang up with Discogs. It got really big really fast. And
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
They kind of marveled at the fact that they were kind of doubling, you know, their traffic, like on hundreds of thousands into the millions. And I think with that, they'll let anyone sell on that site. And sometimes there's, you know, eBay gets like the grifters who sell like fake test pressings. Discogs gets the, you just don't know what the hell they're doing. And I hate to suffer someone's naivete when it's like $30 postage and weeks of my big life.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's a little bit easier, you know, like I'll go in there and get, you know, things like, you know, Japanese editions of CDs that have like a bonus live disc or a bonus sure. disc of whatever it is. And it's like, those seem like they're a little bit harder for somebody to screw it up. Not that it doesn't happen, but that seems a little bit more safer. But I totally hear you. Like I've made those purchases on Discogs or on eBay where it's like, you do get that reaction where it's like the person, well, you know, I charged you $5 shipping. I'm happy to refund, you know, the shipping, you know, since I sent you the wrong record. No, it's worse than that. I don't want the shipping back. I want the right record.
Yeah. And it's not even the money at this point. It's principle. You know,
yeah,
you,
for sure.
you don't love this band. Like I love this band. You should not be in on this platform because you're a lightweight. And it's hard to call yourself heavyweight when you're like, I want the Belgian pressing of this record. Pal, you have just confessed to being a lightweight. If that's what your thing is, like you just kind of fly out the window. But if you're going to be selling something, tell the truth, because there's some of us who like we wake up thinking about this stuff. We take notes like we're obsessed. And I don't mind that aspect of myself because at least it's not an addiction to gambling. At least it's not cocaine or treachery or adultery or like a series of lawsuits. It's music. Like, well, why do you need 5 copies of that record? Like, shut up. Life is short. Like, you know, humans are burdened with like decades of life and a high functioning intellect where we have to figure out things to do. We have so much food available. We have to go to the gym to get it off of us. And so what do you do with all that time? Well, I'd rather research records and listen to music and learn too much about these things than all the other things that humans find themselves doing, like gaming or whatever. It's all, what are you going to do with 60 years of operational, you know, humanity? Like what you, when you can still move your digits and pull your pants up, what are you going to do with the time? And I, you know, I live to work and, you know, I like writing and all the touring and, you know, I'm a work guy. And when I'm not doing all of that, I'm all about the music.
The Stay Fanatic books, among the cast of characters, you've already mentioned one of them that you have put more on my radar, and that is the Buzzcocks. One of the other bands that I have loved seeing you talk about is Hawkwind. And those two bands have always kind of been blind spots for me. Like, so to look at Hawkwind specifically, if somebody is going in, where do they start with Hawkwind from your perspective?
Oh, Fa Sol La Ti Do, Space Ritual, like those two. Anything with Lemmy, was like 5 albums with Lemmy. And those are essential. And I think Hull of the Mountain Grill was his last one. And one of the last times I saw him, I wrote a screenplay before a film he was in, and the director asked me to pick him up, take him to the set, and wrangle him because he'll leave after one take. So as I was on the way with him going to the site, I said, I listened to Fa Sol La Ti Do today. It's a perfect record. He went, too much acoustic. You want Hall of the Mountain Grill. I go, well, Lem, I like that one too. But I was introduced to Hawkwind by Des Cadena of Black Flag, who had amazing taste in music. And his father was the legendary producer-engineer Ozzy Cadena, O-Z-Z-I-E, look him up. Like, work with someone like Charlie Parker or Lightnin' Hopkins. And so Des he ran the Lighthouse Jazz Club. And so Des was, like, birthed in killer music. And he put on Space Ritual. And I maybe had heard the name Hawkwind because it was, like, that band the dude from Motorhead was in before Motorhead. I had Ace of Spades, and that's kind of where it fell off. And he put on, we were at SST Records in 1981, and he put Space Ritual on. I'm like, okay, Oregon Accumulator. Like, what is this? And he explained it to me, and I became a fan ever since. And then in the 80s, became a pal of Lemmy, who's like the coolest guy, and became quite the Hawkwind fan. But, you know, they have some fractured lineup and they still make records. I would advise like the first 6 albums, just get them. There's been some live albums that came out like Record Store Day stuff. Anything from the early 70s, like with Lemmy, Dick Mick, like the guy who played like the instrument. Any of those are, if you like one, you're going to like all of them. they're insanely well recorded. Like really, like you put them on a good system and they really stand up. The Brits, they know how to mic a band. And if you keep liking it, you might want to check out some of the more, you know, there's bootlegs and all kinds of stuff like that. But Hawkwind is just one of those take me to my happy place bands. And whenever I knew I'd see Lemmy, I'd always bring him a Hawkwind record to sign. And he'd always sign it with kind of a gentle insult, you know, probably too loud for you, Henry. Like, thanks a lot, man. And so I still have those, of course.
That's fantastic. Your stories of going to see Led Zeppelin are pretty legendary. What's your general Led Zeppelin go-to record?
Houses of the Holy. It used to be Zeppelin 4 when I was like 15, because it was my school ended on Friday. I've got 48 hours away from the gulag. And the first thing I would do is like come back before I have to go to work. I'd come back and I'd put on the record as I changed into my other outfit to go either to the pet shop or the movie theater, whatever job I had. But I'd have like 20 minutes before I had to go work the shift. And it was always Zeppelin because it's just, you know, such a great band, of course, and such a great record. But as I got older and became Ian MacKaye, my best friend, the guy from Fugazi and Minor Threat, he's the musician. He can like play pretty much everything on stage. I can't play anything. But him as a musician, me as just a fan, we started deconstructing records like when we were kids. Like, what makes this record go? And we would go see Song Remains the Same. Like, it was a, you know, big screen Saturday night, midnight film. And we'd go see it because it's a cheap way to see a rock concert. And so we started like, well, what makes Zeppelin cook? Well, it's the singer. Well, let's drill down deeper. And the deeper you go, I mean, all four of them are great, of course. It's Bonham. Like, what makes it the thing other than just a rock band with an amazing singer? It's Bonham. And like, but why? Well, it's what he's playing. Listen even more. It's what he's not playing. Like, it's the beats he skips. And like Ian is deconstructed. He's got those bootlegs with just the drum tracks. He's like, listen to this. See that? He slipped the, you know, Ian gets all technical. And so for Zeppelin on that aspect, you know, fascinates me because of like, what's Bonham doing? And there's so many interesting moves on Houses of the Holy and Page's guitar sound on that record. And the riffs are so fluid. It's just this, there's no hard edges. You know, Plant is insanely good. The whole band is great. And those songs are just, it's just a beautiful record. There's no Zeppelin record I don't like. It's kind of like the Beatles. They just didn't miss, at least to me. But Houses of the Holy, that's kind of, you put me on a desert island with one Zeppelin record, give me that mono promo record, which I only have a CD bootleg of, and I would be kind of happy with that. It's just a fantastic record, but they're all good, actually.
Yeah, I know as a fan, like for me, it was pretty fascinating. Like when you start to hear guys like Bonham and, you know, I guess maybe even especially like a guy like Phil Collins, these people that as drummers, you can tell it's the guy when you hear him play. And obviously we have that with guitar players as well. You know, I spoke with David Gilmour recently and, you know, David is legendary, you know, because of how much he does without using a lot of notes. And, you know, so as you get to talk to some of these folks, like I asked David about that and David was just like, he's like, I learned eventually that my fingers weren't going to go any faster. So it was that simple with David, but like each of these guys like has something that contributes, obviously Tony Iommi, that contributes to like the way they play. And it's like, I know that for me, that aspect of listening to records growing up. And then, you know, additionally on top of that, like the gateways that you find in the liner notes, like seeing, you know, Steve Gadd on drums or whoever the player is and going, I've seen that person's name in this album. And then like, in some cases, like, you know, as you know, like when you see a record and so played on it that you're familiar with, you're like, I want to hear that record because I like what that person did on this other record that I already love.
You know, that was the jazz thing for me, you know, like, well, Elvin Jones is on this record. Well, damn, he's the Coltrane guy. And what's he doing over here? Well, it's a weekend session. The band wasn't working. He got a session. He took the train uptown. He did the work. And then you find all these people. Everyone's playing with each other. Like Blue Note. It's like a clubhouse. It's like, let's make a record. Like they would divide the room into five sections. Like, all right, go make records today. And so anything like Booker Ervin is on, I want to hear it. Anything Elvin Jones is on, it's going to be interesting enough. If he says yes to the session, at least the drums will be good. And that's the jazz world where everyone, well, some people more than others, but there's just a lot of journeyman musicians who are just really good. And they're insanely prolific. A lot of those Blue Note people, just they're like, 100 records and like really good ones. And that's what made me start to look at the back of like who's in the lineup. Because it's kind of like porn. They all just kind of switch up on the weekends and like see what, you know, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks. That's a weird thing to say about porn. But you know what I mean? You'll see some of your favorite jazz musicians on like 15 different records, and it's not even their band. Or, you know, Eric Dolphy tours with Charles Mingus for a summer, 61 or something, and he's playing like clarinet, saxophone, and flute in one show. So you get these Eric Dolphy records, but they happen to be Mingus records. You get all those bootlegs. They're all insanely good. And Mingus is great anyway, but with Dolphy, it's a Dolphy record. And, you know, there's no bad Dolphy records. And so it was jazz that made me start looking at who's playing on this session, because they just seem to show up and can put it together very quickly, where rock is more, it's more not stagnant. It's just more, you know, like, here's the band. Like, what's Cozy Powell doing over there? How come he's not back with his band? Where the jazz guys kind of mix it up, and then that's just not is more fluid. And so I started trying to understand, like, Mitch Mitchell, you know, Hendrix's drummer. We're like, what's he doing? Like, and I don't think anyone understood Hendrix more than Mitch Mitchell. Like, they were telepathic. And so I started doing that with rock records. Like, why does Sabbath, what is it? And like, I was in this band Black Flag many years ago, and we were all about live performance. You know, we got to, you know, destroy you live. And Greg Ginn, you know, he knows his music. And he said, if you don't have the rhythm section, it doesn't matter what you put on top. Great guitar player with bad drummer and bass player, doesn't matter. Great singer. If the bass and drums aren't locking, like you don't have anything. And that made me listen to Black Sabbath differently. Like, what makes that go? Well, Bill Ward is behind the beat. It's ba-boom. You can be on the beat, behind the beat, or ahead of the beat. It all kind of works. He's behind it. And Geezer Butler is like this elastic, like he's like Mercury. There's this no hard edges with that guy. It almost sounds fretless what he's doing. And he's, you know, and what a great rhythm section. If you put a timer up to him, like Bill is not exactly like you can't do that with him. He's like Keith Moon is more emotive. But when you really get into Sabbath, just listen to the bass and drums, and you're like, wow, that's where it's coming from. And Iommi and Ozzy or Dio or whatever, you know, they get to be the people on top of it. But it's really coming from Geezer and Bill Ward. That's the power center. I'm not, you know, the rest of the band is talented too. And I still do this. And, you know, I was in a band with some serious musicians many years ago, you know, endless van rides, you know, like for it never ends. And we get into those elongated 9-hour discussions, kind of like they do on ESPN talking about like some wide receiver, and they all get mad at each other. Like lots of hyperbole, low impact, you know, no one's fighting at the end of it, but we argue the entire time arguing about who's the better guitar player, Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page. And it was Andrew, the bass player, really smart guy. He said, have you ever listened to a Beatles record and listened to McCartney? I'm like, well, yeah, great singer. Listen to his bass playing. I go, I've never thought of the Beatles as from the rhythm section. He goes like, check it out. McCartney is an insane bass player. And I've never listened to the Beatles the same ever since. And Ringo, he doesn't get nearly enough credit. Great drummer. But McCartney is fascinating as a bass player. And then we're listening to Bob Marley one day, and Andrew said, listen to Bob Marley's guitar playing, which I've never done. I'm just singing along with it because it's like a, you know, it's a lyrical thing for me. It's a message.
Sure.
But you listen to what he's doing, and it is so stoned. It is so cool. And so, you know, the point I'm making is quite often there's more music on that record. And if you can approach it or think about the band or music theory in a different way, these records And the musicians, they've always known this. But like, you know, and you'll go your whole life not knowing how unbelievable the Stax rhythm section is on all those records until you listen to what the snare's doing on like on all those Al Green records. You're like, oh my God, that's the hook. The hook is in the snare. Like the rest of the band is killer, but it's all about that, the back of the beat, that pocket. And I've being around people, musicians who really dissect music. Me, I can't play a single instrument at all. That's how I listen to a lot of music. When it moves me, I try and understand, you know, deconstruct it a little. Mainly, I just want it to move me emotionally. But sometimes I just become so fascinated with an iconic band, you know, like Zeppelin or Sabbath. I just want to know what makes it tick. And that's been really rewarding because you play the same record. Like by the 500th time you've played whatever it is, you can hear it differently.
Yeah, you know, like I found that out recently about, I don't know, I think I heard an interview with Steve Howe, and he was talking about Roundabout. And it's like the beginning of Roundabout is a backwards piano. I never realized that. And I've heard Roundabout for a zillion years.
Sure.
I just thought that that was, you know, some effect on the guitar. So it's just like, whether it's a moment like that, or as you say, like you're having a conversation with somebody, there are these records that we have listened to many times. Maybe we've owned them for decades. And it's like, there's always, I think, new things to discover.
Oh, absolutely. How many times have I played Funhouse by the Stooges? I'd love to know. I'd like a dollar, thank you, for every time.
Yeah.
I'd get a bigger garage. And someone wrote me, a guy listens to my radio show, and I'm forgetting what song it is. But in the middle of it, Iggy goes, this guy wrote me and said, is he doing a Three Stooges thing? And I have heard that record, I swear. I don't know how many hundred times. And I listened to him like, whoa, he is. Like he's being, you know, and those guys love the Three Stooges, Ron Ashton. And I've heard that record so many times, and I've actually heard that, but I never heard it. And this guy pointed it out to me, and it jumps out at me every time I play it now. But it was like the 1100th time I listened to the record, I heard that. I'm like, okay. Wow, where have I been? And so I live for all that stuff. It's, you know, I like all those behind the scenes. VH1 did that series. I don't have a TV, but I saw it once somewhere where Daltrey has some Who record and he's just pushing up. He's in the recording studio and he's like pushing up the fans. Yeah. Like, well, see what Keith is doing here. I'm like, I love this. Like, I don't want this show to end. It's fascinating, especially when you have access to the multis. It's insane.
Yeah, you know, it is absolutely insane. That's a series, I think, called Classic Albums. And it's like, okay, of course, done Dark Side of the Moon and, you know, all the classic records, Asia by Steely Dan and so on. Like all that stuff is, anybody hearing this, it's out there on DVD and streaming and so on. But you mentioned Iggy and knowing of your love for Iggy and the Stooges, and you're a Bandcamp guy too. Something that came up on my Facebook feed recently that I'm curious if you have heard, because of all the random stuff that you listen to. Have you seen that there's some guy or band or person out there that's put out a version of a Stooges' first record played only on chairs?
No, that has escaped me. Chairs.
I was like, I'm going to have to mention that to Henry because that seems like something random that you would want to know about being such a fan.
Is it like what,
I just kind of skimmed
a percussion it, like, thing? Like how does one play a chair?
I skimmed it, and it's exactly kind of what you would think hearing that description. It's presumably just a guy banging on chairs.
Okay,
so it's like, so it seems
a,
like
a percussion type of idea.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, there you go.
Yeah. So there's, yeah. Well, you did an interview recently with the Music Book Podcast. And one of the things you said that I really loved was you said the people that you still think about are people that you've met through music. And I think that we can all identify with that sentiment. You know, I know that, like, you know, when I look at certain albums or, you know, I can think about how I got into that album, how I got into that band, the person that introduced me and so on, you know, and similarly, you know, if I think of certain friends, like, you know, you've mentioned Ian MacKaye a number of times. When I think of certain friends, like, I know the bands that I associate with that person because we got into them together, lived, you know. So many of these types of behavior that you chronicle in the Stay Fanatic books are these kinds of things. From your side of things, like, what do you enjoy about the journaling process of doing these books and et cetera? Like, what comes back for you out of doing these that you really enjoy?
It's basically, I'm looking for consensus. The writing is a one-way conversation. It's a letter, you know, hey, fanatic, with an exclamation point, unless someone has died. And then there's a period because you can't be happy when like someone in a band passes away. And so it's just basically, it's really enthusiastic looking for someone to go, yeah, I know. Like, I just got this Belgian pressing of this fanatic. It's insane. And you're hoping the person reading goes like, oh man, I love that record. And so I started writing that way. I live alone. I work alone. I'm a very solitary cat. And I just was looking, basically it's a fanzine where fanzines are just basically examples of enthusiasm. Like, I'm so into this band, I'm going to write about Billy Idol for 33 pages. It's like, you know, like the nerd girl at 15 has a crush on, you know, whoever it is, like Duran Duran. And her notebook is full of like, you know, love letters to the players. And that's kind of like a fanzine. It's a love letter to music. And so I started that writing many years ago. And after about 2 years of writing like a mad fool, I harvested my courage and I read it back. I'm like, okay, this might work, but it's going to need a lot of pictures to really make it come alive. So I better get a scanner. And that was the start of that series. I think the writing started in 2013, and sadly it goes on to this day. And so it's basically a way to, you know, it's not for me to tell you what to listen to. It's, you know, I'm not a professor, but I do have a lot of enthusiasm. I do spend a lot of time with this stuff. I do like writing, and I do have a lot of images that look cool when you scan them. So why not make an overachiever's fanzine? And I do like the Stay Fanatic Volume 4, the new one. That was edited in, I think, 26 or 27 countries. You know, because I do a lot of travel for shows and whatnot. And so I go to record stores like from here to Moscow, literally. Saudi Arabia, been to record stores in Saudi Arabia. They have them, believe it or not. And they tripped on me because I was like pulling up CDs. Oh, I love this guy. Like, who is this weird tattooed man yelling in our store? And you know, I've bought them in records all over the world. And I just want that enthusiasm to hit those pages. And maybe it's a book that someone looks forward to when they come out every other year. But that's basically it. Just like hoping someone picks up on the signal. And maybe from reading the book, they go, wow, that the way he describes it, I better go and check out that band. And these days, any band that's mentioned in those books, you can listen for free right now, either Bandcamp or YouTube. So your curiosity can be satiated without spending money. And then, you know, fair enough. And I like the idea of Bandcamp. Like, I want to hear your band. Well, I can listen and make a decision. And if I really like it, I'll buy it. I don't have to get it in the mail or go to the store and come home and be disappointed and settle with a record that was 3 hours of minimum wage pay. And so that's why I can be very free with the suggestions, because you can go right now and play any reference in Stay Fanatic Volume 4. I'm sure you can listen to within seconds for the best price. And like, if it sucks to you, fair enough. You know, like, great. Like, at least no harm, no foul. It took a minute and a half of your life. And Henry has bad taste in music. Like, next. But you didn't pay. And maybe it rubbed off on you. You know, because I get a lot of mail, a lot of incoming about the radio show and the books. Like, hey, Henry, it's everything from, hey, I got into this band because of your radio show. The best version of that is, hey, Henry, we're this band on tour, and every night people are coming up to us saying, I came to the show because I heard you on Henry's radio show. Thank you. I'm like, are you kidding? Like, you're welcome. That's one of the main reasons I have a radio show. Get these bands heard, get people to the gig, get them to the record store. You're like, let's keep this, you know, independent music, in my opinion, it's a conversation that's ours to lose. It's ours. Maintain it. It's like a park. You got to keep it. keep it maintained. Otherwise, you lose it. It dies or it gets taken over. And so that's basically the spirit is a lot of hyperbole, enthusiasm, hence all the exclamation points, all the pictures, and way too much information about far too few things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned hearing from the listeners and hearing from the readers, and that was an aspect I was curious about, because like you'll write about, like, say, a Buzzcocks pressing, for example, that, like, it's not on Discogs. I don't have a lot of information. Like, so I wondered, like, you kind of put the flag up, and I wondered how many instances there have been where information has come back that's kind of helped you close the loop on some of these things you write about in these volumes of Stay Fanatic.
Rarely, because I am often, sometimes, able to get to an actual band member, and I'm not trying to put anyone down. They're useless. They're like, what are you talking about? Like, I've had members of bands at my house and shown them records of theirs. Like, I've never seen this. Like, it's your third single. You never knew it came out in France as a 7 and a 10 inch or a 12 inch. They're like, no. I'm like, get out. They're no help whatsoever. And so every once in a while I'll connect with someone who perpetrated the record. They're like, can't help you, man. But those references at this point are so obscure. The person who knows about that record has the same questions that I do. And that's I'll just get some other train spotter guy, some guy lives in his mom's basement and, in Scotland. Like, I know, man, I've been looking for that. If you find out anything, let me know. And we'll go to our graves, never knowing. So rarely do I get that circle closed. And I would love to give you some aha moments, but man, not one comes to mind at all. It's usually, you go to the rock star's house and go, where's your cool stuff? Like, I don't have any. And I've heard this from two people. I will not name them. And I asked them, sure, where's your cool stuff? And they both of them said the same two words, too high. They're just back in the day, just too high. What happened to this thing? Sold it for dope. What happened to this? I don't know. Got up in a house fire. Like they live these crazy lives. They just kind of, as they went, they left a trail of destruction. So it's real. And they don't have any of it. They have reissues of their stuff, but they don't have any of the t-shirts. And me, on the other hand, I kept it all. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that's kind of interesting about doing these Stay Fanatic books is that, like, with some folks, you could see that this could be a good way to stay engaged with your collection, but I never get the impression that you really lose connection with your collection. Like, you're always listening to things, always playing things. But in the process of writing and really just kind of exploring these records and bands the way you do, how often have there been kind of just, you said the term a minute or so ago, aha moment. How often have you had, like, kind of some of those aha moments just about these records that you love, and as you're explaining them to the fellow fanatics, you realize or you uncover certain things?
That happens now and then. And that's usually by taking, and I have more than one magnifying glass, and like looking up all the publishing information on the label or looking up the Matrix information. Like, whoa, that's a different mastering on the A side than the B side. And like Discogs is great for that. They have a lot of amazing Matrix information. And you'll find out, one of your favorite 7 inches, there's like 8 different pressings of it from like, the Pittman plant and this plant. And there's all, if you want more, it's out there. Looks the same, sounds the same, but there's different Matrix information. And so sometimes when you're telling someone about a record or showing it to them, something will jump out. I've had these like silent moments of whoa, where I like kind of forget to breathe. I've uncovered some collections in the last few years where I've met some, fellow old geezers, and they're, timing out. They're just, their priorities change, or they would need some cash. And I'm able to procure like 40 years of hardcore collecting in one go, like whoop. And I load it in my car and I drive it home. And a lot of people who have this stuff, they don't necessarily know what they have, or they don't assess it like they're trying to find who done it at a crime scene. And, it's not the clinical definition of going through something forensically. But I have a lot of contracts and receipts of bands that I'm obsessed with. So I can prove the band was in Los Angeles on that day because the guy ate a steak at the restaurant. I've got the receipt. And it's because of that, I have made these, like, where I just sit in silent amazement at an invoice from Studio Instrument Rental, a SIR in Los Angeles, where I can prove that guy was in the band for one show. Because in my gloved hand, I try never to touch the principal document. In my gloved hand, about to go to the scanner, I have the receipt for two sets of Ernie Ball guitar strings the guy bought for the one show he did, where there's like no photos, there's no recording, but I've got the freaking receipt, man. And stuff like that, I lose sleep. And there's really no one I actually know. Like if I sent Ian that invoice and said, this, like, he'll go, like, he, you know, we've been best friends since we were 12. He's a very patient man. And he'll go, well, that's great, Henry. That's great, man. Like he suffers me. There's really no one. I don't know many people anyway, but there's like no one I can send that to and go, right? And have them go, right, yeah, yeah. I send this kind of stuff to my manager, this one woman who's been hectoring and emasculating me for 27 years. And sure. she's like, yeah, great, great. Just keep working. Got to keep the lights on. And so I kind of have these epiphanies solo weirdo. I'm on my own. And this stuff is, to me, and maybe this is what historians and those Egyptologists, when they get that aha moment where they find like the thing, like, ah, now the dots connect. And I've had a handful of those in the last few years because of these collections I've been able to be right time, right place to acquire, where I've got some of the story. And then suddenly you get three chapters of the story in one go instead of getting it piecemeal at auctions or eBay. It's like trying to put the feathers back on a bird. And every once in a while, you get an entire wing's worth. You're like, whoa. Most of the time, it's like, aha, it's a tail feather, I think. And so I'm trying to reconstruct some band's histories or just to see, you know, what they were into, what they were going through. And, you know, some people have passed away and their families have their stuff. And sometimes it goes up for auction, like the estate. Like right now on Omega, the Omega auction site, Mark Smith of The Fall, the guy wrote every day. I mean, he was prolific and very ornery and brilliant. The family is selling like his notes and his rough sketch of this album. And like the prices, I can't afford this stuff. If I could, I'd want all of it. Because it's like his notes on these lyrics, you know, half typed, half Mark E. Smith scrawl. And they go up a page or two at a time every 4 months at Omega. And the Smith family, I guess the parents and the sisters are just selling this stuff off. And it's too bad that they just didn't try and keep it all together and make a museum or donate it to a university like, you know, Manchester. And so like scholars could go through it. Or just put it all on online digitally so we could all have a gander. And so now and then you get an entire collection. You can go, okay, now I can relitigate the past. So, and this is, as a 60-year-old guy, this is what's been bringing me a lot of joy and enthusiasm for the last several years.
There's the first part of our conversation with Henry Rollins. His Stay Fanatic books are available at henryrollins.com. And you can continue on to our next episode to hear the second half of our conversation with Henry. Please rate and review wherever you're hearing this. And thanks for listening to the UCR podcast.